Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, October 23rd. By my calculations, I'm Ray Graff. Today, we welcome back Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson to talk astronomy with you. We got a couple of comets, a meteor shower, a phony moon, lots of stuff to talk about. If you have a question about the heavens, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551 for your astronomy questions, or email voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. I love the astronomy shows, and we have two good astronomers here. We'll be back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers in the studio today to answer your questions about space. One of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world, Bob Berman, is here. He's astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Dr. Valerie Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. If you have a question for these two, give us a call right now. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. 800-348-2551 if you want to call in. Hello, Dr. Valerie Rapson. What's happening?
Oh, things are really good. We're taking some students to a conference on Saturday here in Skidmore, or at Skidmore College.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited
for that.
What's
the conference about?
Well, it's the kind of like once or twice a year, all the astronomers in New York State get together, and we bring our students, and we just kind of show off all the work we've been doing. So we've got students that are going to talk about a particle detector that they built and launched on a rocket last summer.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that wasn't me. That was my colleague, Josh Nolenberg. He had some students doing really awesome work.
Yeah.
But my students are talking about their exoplanet work. There's a student who's modeling rings around a dwarf planet. So we're bringing a whole cohort of students this way again this weekend, and it's going to be so much fun.
How many exoplanets are we up to now? Have we lost count?
No, I looked yesterday because I had to do it for my class. 6,028 is the official number right now.
When I took astronomy in college 112 years ago, the professor annoyed me greatly by saying, oh, yes, there are planets and out orbiting other stars. Mm-hmm. And I said, sir, which ones? And he said, well, they're not officially found yet.
Right, right.
But now there are a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
40 years down the road,
yeah.
We have 6,000 plus.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And more every day, I assume.
Literally. Like, you know, I'm that nerd that gets a push notification every time we find a new one. You know, I got an app that sends me a notification, so.
You know, they talk about the Goldilocks zone, and sort of a spot in the solar system of whatever solar system where it's possible that there is liquid water and life could be. How many are in those Goldilocks zones?
We found about 40 or so Earth-sized planets that are in the habitable zone. And, you know, there's a lot more that goes into it. We don't know if these planets have water or an atmosphere yet, but they're in that, you know, good spot. Yeah, not nearly as many as you would think. There's probably more out there, but if you want to find the small planets, it's really hard.
Yeah.
You need the big telescopes, and it's going to take more time to find them all.
Bob Berman, you are here. What's happening with you, sir?
Happening. Well, no tours yet. Those are yet to come, and especially early next year and later next year. No, it's really work for the Old Farmer's Almanac. We've got the 2027 issue now out night by night, what's happening in the night sky. And also we're about to work on the and do the moon calendar. We do a calendar month by month. Special things about the moon.
Okay. And you had sent an email earlier in the week saying, all right, we got two comets and a meteor shower. You can't really see the comets with the naked eye, though, right?
No. And you're right. This is a balancing act because if you hype it too much and people look, they'll be disappointed. We don't want anyone to be turned off to astronomy. On the other hand, if it is easily viewable, we don't want people to feel they've missed something. And one of those two comets is now out. As soon as night falls, say about an hour and a half after sunset, if you look low in the west, sweep that area with binoculars. You really need binoculars. And if you are in a dark area, you'll see the comet. So that's kind of exciting. And we're going to get a meteor shower. It's actually underway. The Orionids, not one of those one-a-minute ones like what we have on December 13th.
You poo-poo this one usually every year.
Well, you know what? Because there's major showers where you get one meteor a minute. And then there are the lesser showers where you have to wait 5 or 10 or 15 minutes, even if you have dark skies. And not everybody has the patience to set out a lawn chair and stare at the sky for 15 minutes in the hopes of seeing one, usually not super bright, shooting star. But some people might want to see that. And one every 10 minutes isn't that bad. And if you're not in a city, you have to be out in dark skies. Look for it tonight if it's clear.
Okay.
Is the moon phase good? I didn't check.
And the moon is good. The moon is absent. Oh, that's the other important thing.
It'll be nice and dark.
You know, Valerie, I love looking up at the sky at night, and we always peer north anytime there's any solar activity and we mm-hmm. want to see northern lights. Mm-hmm. How long does it take, in your experience, for your eyes to get used to the dark?
Well, I think it depends on, you know, each individual's eyesight, but they say to go out, you know, for at least 10 or 15 minutes to like really get dark adapted. And you'll notice an improvement, you know, a lot sooner than that. But I think the real difference comes after about 10 minutes or so at least. And even more, you know, will always be better. So you really got to get nice and dark. And the activity, if you want to see like the aurora and the northern lights, it's got to be pretty strong so that you're adapted enough and you can see the glow in the sky.
You sent an article, I think, today. Will Earth have two moons orbiting? Astronomers explain the quasi-moon.
I know.
What's up with that?
We keep seeing these things about, like, mini-moons, quasi-moons that are showing up. And they found this, like, super faint object. We're talking magnitude 26, which is, you know, so faint it rivals the faintest galaxies we've ever seen. And it's just this tiny little rock that happens to be orbiting the sun almost exactly in the same orbit that Earth is. So this little rock's going to kind of follow us along as we go around the Earth. And it's just going to be kind of hanging out nearby for like the next 60 years or so.
Now, that's not that uncommon, right? I mean, this happens fairly over the course of millennia, will happen again and again.
We have tons of, you know, little asteroids that are relatively close to Earth. This one just, you know, hadn't been seen until now because it's so small and so faint. And its orbit matches ours so closely that, you know, it might look like it's orbiting the Earth, but in reality, it's just following us as we go around the sun.
Cool. We are talking astronomy today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Glenn writes in, please explain what makes 3-1, is it 3-1 Atlas?
3-I.
3-I Atlas and SWAN. What makes these two cometary events and objects so different from any others that have come through our solar system?
Well, should I go?
Yeah.
A comet bright enough to appear over even cities through light pollution is called a great comet. You know, that adjective sounds like it's informal. Oh, look at that. That's a pretty great comet. But that's actually the term for it. It happens typically every 50 to 20 years irregularly. So those are very exciting events. Now, what will make a particular object get bright enough? It has to be big enough, and especially it has to be close enough both to the sun and to the Earth so that its outer layer of volatile substances, especially water vapor, turns into gas, sublimates, and then glows by sunlight or becomes a plasma so that it glows on its own. Now, that did happen. The caller is asking about Comet Atlas. You're talking about Suchinshan Atlas. That was exactly a year ago, last October, and that was the last time a comet was visible to just the naked eye. Now we have one, but it needs binoculars.
But, Valerie, this one's interstellar, right?
Yes, I think so. So there's a bunch of them. They're all kind of nicknamed Atlas because they're based off of, like, you know, the coordination that found them. This one, I think, is the interstellar one that came from literally interstellar space. So we're particularly interested in that because we want to learn more about it. Where exactly did it come from? And that one's kind of headed out now, I believe. So it's going to get fainter and fainter as it goes.
You got to look with the telescope?
Not with that one.
No,
unfortunately. We're going to try for the ones we talked about a few minutes ago, you know, Comet Lemon and Comet Swan. We might be able to see them with our telescope, but we also don't have the best horizon to see them. So it's going to be a little tricky.
So these two, you said Lemon and Swan,
mm-hmm.
they're in this solar system. They're from the Oort cloud and they keep passing around?
Right. We don't know exactly where they came from. We can make some rough predictions. I think one of them we think orbits every couple thousand years. The other one is much longer, you know, tens of thousands of years. And that's just based on, you know, the few days or weeks that we've actually observed them closely. We try and predict their orbit and how far out they're going to go. But these ones do seem to be bound to our solar system.
Okay.
And since we're talking about them, here's how to find it. Lemon in particular is definitely findable. Normally, I don't want anyone to feel hopeless, but this one's hopeful. It's at its closest to Earth this week. So this is the brightest it's going to be. It's high enough above where the sun sets so that it's not impossible. And here's the story. As soon as darkness falls, if you're in a dark place, not in the middle of a city, but in a dark place, as soon as darkness falls, figure about 90 minutes after sunset, which is kind of early-ish these nights, look towards the west, the direction the sun set, and look for the Big Dipper's handle. That'll sort of be to your right a little bit. Follow the Big Dipper's handle, curve it downward, look a little to the left of that spot.
Okay.
And you know what? You won't see it because you need binoculars.
Okay.
But drag those old binoculars you've got in some drawer somewhere, sweep that area of sky, and you'll see it.
Seeing comets through binoculars is so cool.
It really is.
The last one that was visible that I can remember with the naked eye a few years ago around my house, we put the binoculars on it, and it was spectacular.
Yeah,
let's take a break. 800-348-2551. More people want to talk about 3i Atlas. We'll get to the email bag in a little bit. Barbara in Wurtsboro has been waiting. We'll get to the phones next. Zappa here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's Astronomy Today. We got Dr. Valerie Raps, and we have Bob Berman, and we have a phone bank that's ready to roll. 800-348-2551. Let's go to Barbara in Wurtsboro. Barbara, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. Thanks. I have a question regarding a supposedly new discovery in physics.
Okay.
Connected with quantum mechanics. It's called tunneling. And I wondered if you could possibly tell me something about it.
Tunneling. Okay.
Well, impossible things logically and in classical science are routine in the quantum world. And one of them is that, let's say you have an object like a subatomic particle, and it shouldn't penetrate something, should not be able to penetrate, shouldn't get to the other side, or even it could be a bit of energy. But in the quantum world, since things do every possible situation, take every possible choice, it can actually appear on the other side of seemingly impenetrable objects. So you have that. You have things like EPR correlations where you have communication between objects that are through extensive space that are just simply impossible to penetrate instantaneously, light speed no longer being a limit. So it's one of the impossible features of quantum mechanics that we've now grown accustomed to.
Oh. Wow.
Hang on. Valerie wants to add something,
yeah,
Barbara. Go ahead.
And I wanted to give you like a real example of this that we actually experience all the time in space, and it's literally the sun. So deep inside the sun, there's energy being made through fusion, where hydrogen atoms smash together, make helium, and they make energy. But technically speaking, in our normal physics, that can't happen. The hydrogen atoms are not moving fast enough to overcome the forces that resist them to actually smash into each other and make helium. So we have to rely on this quantum tunneling process to actually get those atoms close enough together to fuse and stick to make energy. So the sun, which we experience every day, is like a literal example that quantum physics is happening, and we're seeing it on a much larger scale.
What do you think, Barbara?
I think it's still a mystery.
I agree with you.
But it's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
Well,
something's going on. We don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your help.
Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. Speaking of the sun, I heard a bit on Stardate maybe a couple days ago about a red giant far away. Take me through the lifespan. What makes it so big? And it's it's pretty cool, relatively speaking, by that point, right? Mm-hmm. The red giant?
Yeah.
So what's going on? Is it still fusion that's going on at that point in its life?
Yeah. So when stars age, they basically, you know, they run out of hydrogen eventually on the inside. And what happens is whenever the fusion pauses, the star is trying to get back to equilibrium. It's trying to fuse again. So what happens is the inner core shrinks and it gets hotter. It triggers fusion again. And that kind of burst of energy that's created pushes the star outward. So the inside, which we can't physically see, you know, pulses in and out from pausing fusion, starting fusion, you know, back and forth. And this process ultimately causes the star to puff up and get larger. And as it gets larger, it cools off because it's further out. It's just a bigger object. So we see them as red giants, as larger, colder stars of lower density, because they're just trying to get back to the normal equilibrium, which they can never reach because they used up most of their hydrogen fuel.
Ah, interesting. And Bob, your book, The Sun's Heartbeat, is a very cool beginner book for those of us who want to learn about the sun and stars in general. When our sun, Sol, or whatever they call it, goes red giant, will it be big enough to engulf the Earth?
It's going to be a close call. Some experts think its surface is going to be just short of Earth's orbit. Others believe it's going to be beyond our orbit, and we're going to orbit it inside of it for as long as that works out for us. So it's going to be, let's say, it's going to be pretty much up to our orbit. But, you know, we're looking at 4 to 5 billion years in the future.
So how do you know?
Well, because this is a stellar evolution, which we pretty much have down. As Valerie was explaining, that's how the process works. And it's really dictated by how much stuff, mass, weight the star has to begin with. That dictates everything. A heavy star will get hotter because its core is squeezed more, so the nuclear processes happen faster. Hotter means it's bluer, uses up more fuel, dies in its early age, or explodes into a supernova. But then you get a star like our sun. It's been around for almost 5 billion years. It's got another 5 billion to go. But lest we get too optimistic, remember, in only 1.1 billion years, it will be 10% more luminous than it is now. And now that's believed that will be enough to change Earth's average temperature to 700 degrees. Oof. So end of the road.
It's rough.
So then if we could find a way to reinvigorate Mars' magnetic field, then it would be in a prime spot to have life again.
More than magnetic field, we need more of an atmosphere to hold liquid water on the surface. As you know, water only exists as a liquid under pressure. So you need that pressure. You need an atmosphere. That's what you really
need.
But
it did have one once, right?
Yes, yes. It had one once.
And how then, being that it's what, a third of the size of the Earth?
What, about half the size.
Half the size of the Earth. And so it couldn't keep that, right? It couldn't keep the atmosphere.
Right.
Was it a cometary strike that, I mean, there was water there. I mean, how can there be water there and then the atmosphere just dissolves? What was the event that dissolved it? Mm-hmm. And by the way, the number here is 800-348-2551.
Because Mars has less gravitational pull than we do, it couldn't hold on to its early atmosphere. So that it developed an early atmosphere, isn't that strange? That it couldn't hold on to it, what happens is it leaks into space because every molecule, every atom of gas in the atmosphere has a certain speed. Now, ones that happen to be faster than average are going to exceed the escape velocity of that planet. Our escape velocity is enough to hold in our atmosphere. We get a little stuff leaking into space, but not much. Mm-hmm. Mars couldn't do that, so it lost it.
All right. Now, Valerie, you have studied exoplanets for a long time. Mm-hmm. Does that mean, then, that there is a certain size, a certain mass of a planet where you can pretty much exclude it from the possibility of having an atmosphere?
Well, not necessarily, because, you know, there is the thing that Bob was talking about, the gravity. So smaller planets, it's going to be harder for them to have an atmosphere in general. But it also matters how far away they are from the star, because part of the reason that these particles get so energetic is their natural motion, but also the stellar winds from their star is going to excite the particles, too. So if you've got an Earth-sized planet that's like way out at the orbit of Neptune, you know, it's probably not going to be habitable for a variety of reasons, but it could still have an atmosphere out there because the sun isn't affecting it as much.
Could a planet, a theoretical planet far away from a sun, generate its own heat somehow in the core, enough heat to...
Well, we do, because we give off about twice as much heat as you get from the sun. And when you stand with your feet on Earth, heat is actually coming up from the Earth, mostly from radioactive decay. And we know that's true because you watch the volcanoes go up. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as you, and the core of the Earth is not that much cooler than the surface of the sun. We're hot. And so, yeah.
So then theoretically, if there was a planet that had enough radioactive material to really create some heat, mm-hmm. and maybe it was a rogue planet,
yeah.
could it in fact have conditions for life?
Potentially, sure. I mean, Pluto is kind of an interesting example. Not that we think Pluto is habitable, but it does have that like heart shape on the side that seems to be melted. And a lot of the theories are saying that there's some sort of material, may it be radioactive or some other process, where energy heat is coming from the inside and literally melting the surface. And we never expected this for such a small object so far from the sun. We didn't think the interior would be nearly as active as it appears to be. So we're seeing stuff like this in our solar system. So it's not out of the question that something might be similar.
Yeah, it can't be an accident that Pluto is its own emoji.
Nice. Well, boy, you're a hipster, aren't you? Good for you. Bob Berman is here, and so is Valerie Rapson. It's Astronomy Today, 800-348-2551. If you have a question, you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Ben in Providence writes, what are the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn? Are they based on constellations? What are they?
No, they're not based on constellations. They're based on our tilt, because picture Earth tilt and Earth's tilt and the sun is coming from an angle. Well, when we're at our maximum tilt one way or the other, that is on June 21st and December 21st, there is a limit to where the sunlight can shine or cannot shine. And that's a certain latitude. And those latitudes are simply called the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn. The one in the north, that is, you're talking about north of the equator, 23.5 degrees north of the equator, is the Tropic of Cancer. You know, the what is called the Tropic of Capricorn, based on, yes, where the sun was at that time of year when that happened, 2,000 years ago, when the constellations actually lined up with the zodiacal signs or the zodiacal signs. I've looked that up. Believe it or not, both are correct. The zodiac signs matched up with the constellations. They don't anymore, but who cares? Okay.
But they will again someday, right?
Eventually, maybe.
In 26,000 years.
Fair enough. Andrew writes, and now we talked a little bit about 3i Atlas, but Andrew writes, can you tell us about it? What is unique about it? Is there any concern or research to prove that this object is not one of the many headed our way? Not that we should be concerned, but how do we know it's not one of those objects heading in our direction?
It's going away from us, actually.
Yeah, it's already coming around, you know, from outer space, and we've been watching it for many months now, so we're pretty sure what the orbit is going to look like. But it came in, you know, from a slightly different orbit than the plane of our solar system, so that's kind of how we know it's interstellar. It's in a hyperbolic orbit, which means it's not going to be bound to the sun, and it's already looped around and it's kind of heading away. So we don't think it's going to, you know, ever come back or really cause much danger. It made its close approach already, and now it's just going to kind of head on out past the outer planets.
And we know now, we're convinced that Avi Loeb's little thought experiment that it could be some sort of artificial. We know it's a comet now, right?
Yeah, we're you know, as sure as we could be that this is just a regular interstellar cometary object. We've seen no additional evidence for the contrary.
Okay, fair enough. So Bob was right all along. 800-348-2551 is our number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Chris in Medusa writes, thanks for scratching the old astronomy itch. Well, we try to do it every month. I was wondering, says Chris, if you could steer me in the direction of a good starter telescope. I used to have an Orion SkyQuest that was phenomenal for viewing the moon. Maybe I needed more magnifiers, but it was lost in a move. I'd like to see further with more clarity. And that's from Chris in Medusa, New York.
Yeah. I mean, Bob and I always disagree slightly about these. I always suggest, you know, the Dobsonian-style telescopes.
Oh, now, what is that?
No, I agree with you. Those are good.
Yeah, those are nice.
What is that?
They're the ones, they sit on a small wooden base. You can usually get them anywhere between, like, 6 and 12 inches.
Yeah.
I like the 6 to 8-inch range because they're big enough to see good stuff, but also small enough to carry. You don't need to, like, lug it out there. But, no, those are just kind of the easiest to maneuver. They're usually not electronic in any way, so you have to learn your way around the sky and point them, but they're just very simple to use, and after a few times it gets easy to move them. If you want to invest more and go the electronic route, those are nice, but you have to learn how to calibrate them and set them up, and they can be a little bit more of a struggle than they're worth, in my opinion, for starting astronomers.
Valerie's absolutely right in what she said. Now, here's the thing. With the Dobsonian, almost all of the money goes in the optics, which it should. Mm-hmm. And the rest of it is a cardboard tube on a kind of Lazy Susan mount. Unbelievably cheap, both in the sense of it's nice that it's inexpensive. But also, here's the problem. It is great. And if you're going to be using it a few times, the moon, Saturn, that's it. Fine. That's what you should do. But if you have any chance of having a serious and continued hobby of astronomy or interest in astronomy, my experience is that fairly soon you get a little frustrated with the fact that the sky moves. Mm-hmm. So that once you've found an object and it's in there, in less than a minute, it won't be in the eyepiece anymore. You'll have to physically put your hand on it, nudge it, and nudge it in the right way so that you reacquire the Saturn or the crater you were looking at. And you have to keep doing it while you're using it. You have to continually move that telescope. Now, the ones with a plug-in motor, track it. But as Valerie pointed out, to really track it, every time you use it, you have to set up so that it's pointed in the right direction, or you have to go through some electronic steps, find a star, confirm what it is, press a button, go to another star.
Yeah.
And do you really want to go through those steps? So you see, it's not an easy answer.
Mm-hmm. All right. There's some cool ones now. I don't know the brand names off the top of my head, but they're basically GPS based. And I'm told that you can just like set it outside, tell it, you know, your latitude and longitude, because it just needs to know that. And it will literally find and confirm all the stars almost completely on its own, which sounds amazing.
Right,
and I
right.
need to try this, but I haven't had my own personal experience with it yet.
But have one you? Thing to be careful of is a lot of the telescopes that do that automatically, you can't look through.
Yeah,
you can't see the object. They're only photographic.
Oh.
So they'll take an image and give it to your smartphone, but you can't have the satisfaction of looking at something.
Mm-hmm.
So make sure what you're getting.
I mean, I love the astronomical grade binoculars that you suggested for us years ago, Valerie, and they're phenomenal. And I'm going to try to find that comet if it's clear tonight. Mm-hmm. The number is 800-348-2551. You can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Every day, this is from John, every day during the weathercast, the amount of daylight loss is given. Why is it different every day?
We're at a time of the year now where it's at maximum. During August, September, and October, mm-hmm. the loss of light is at the fastest of the year. And it's simply that Earth's tilt again. We're at the part of our orbit where the angle of our tilt changes rapidly. Whereas within a month, either side of the solstices, we're pointed at the sun. And a month before or after, we're still pretty much the same pointed at the sun. So there isn't much change. So what you'll see is, unfortunately, here's the issue. Some meteorologists will round off the minutes because their tables round off to the nearest minute.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes, some days, they'll say, we've lost 3 minutes of daylight. But the next day, they'll say, we've lost 4 minutes of daylight. And people justifiably say, how can there be that kind of a switch? But those who go by the second, you'll see it changes by a few seconds a day, but not more than that. And as I said, this is when, right now, this is when it changes the fastest.
Mm-hmm. And it's latitude dependent, too. I remember, you know, years ago when my family moved to Florida and I went and visited and I was like, wow, it's almost 12 hours of daylight all the time here. And like, you know, astronomically, I knew that, but I never really experienced it before. So it really depends on where you live. If you're more south near the equator, you don't experience that change nearly as much. But up here in New York State, it's really significant around this time.
Yeah,
of year.
At the equator, people like in Quito, cities like that, very close to the equator or on the equator, it doesn't change at all. The amount of daylight and night stays exactly the same throughout the year.
All right, one more email since we're talking about telescopes and binoculars. This email from Mike at Rexford, then we'll take a break and then we'll go back to the phones. It's Astronomy with Valerie Rapson at Bob Berman, 800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. Mike in Rexford writes, if you're trying to see a comet with naked eye without success, try taking a photo of the area with your iPhone. Mm-hmm. The iPhone is more sensitive to light than our eyes. You may see the comet in your photo. This has worked for me. True, not true?
True.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And you can kind of, you know, you'll get some stars in the background, too. So that might help you pinpoint exactly where to look, especially if you're zoomed out. If you can see, you know, the handle of the dipper or something in your picture, then you know exactly where to look.
Yeah, we saw the same thing with the aurora. During the last year, we've had an unusual number of auroras, not too surprisingly, since we're at solar max right now. The sun is at its most active. And people found that by holding their iPhone up to the sky, they'd see a slight little grayish glow, and they'd wonder, is that an aurora? But holding the phone up, taking a 30-second exposure, if your phone will let you do that.
Well, how do you keep your hand steady that long?
Well, because it's such a wide field, fortunately, if you can reasonably steady it, you'll get a reasonable, especially of the aurora, which is kind of blurry to begin with. And if you see any color, usually green, but this past year we had a number of red ones. That's your key, because nothing in the sky is going to glow green or red except for an aurora.
Let's take a break. It's 800-348-2551. Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. We'll be back. Demented enough. That's Terry Snyder, Guys and Dolls. It's Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. All right, it's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. And let's go back to the phone, shall we? Dave is in Clarence. Dave, go ahead.
Hey, Ro. How are you doing?
Good.
Good. Three-part question.
All right.
Can we see the edge of the universe, or is it too far away? Or is there nothing there?
That's a good question.
Well, all right. Well, Bob, you start.
It's in Socrates.
Okay.
It really is. And it's also everywhere because when you think of it, anything that's expanding equally and has been doing so from the beginning, if you're embedded with it, you'll just see things closer to you moving away slower and things that are farther moving away faster. And you'd conclude that the center of the universe or the locus of all the expansion or the place where it was born is right where you are. Everyone sees that. So when you're talking about the edge, the same thing applies. We are at the edge of the universe for somebody else. There, and this sounds like being evasive,
yes,
but believe it or not, this is the best way of answering it.
Valerie, do you agree?
Well, and too, like, I think when we look back, you know, we think about the edge of the universe in that sense. It's not really the edge of where it is now. We're looking back towards the beginning, but we're limited by the speed of light. And we know that space has expanded faster than the speed of light. We're still, you know, trying to figure out exactly how that happened, but it does. And so we have a limit to how far back in time we can see. So that's our observable universe. And that's as far as we can actually see. But again, that's looking back in time as opposed to thinking about, you know, the edge right now of our universe.
Dave, what do you think of that?
I'm going to Socrates.
Exactly, man. That's the center of it all. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Red Hook. Also, perhaps the center of the universe. Sam, you're on.
Hi, guys. Here's a question from some of my reading. How is it that entropy, low entropy from the sun, is what fuels our planet with energy and not the actual energy itself that actually is what gives life on Earth?
Well, I think you're thinking of, like, you know, the thermal energy that's being emitted by the sun that travels to our planet and then our atmosphere and things trap it in. And that's what helps regulate our temperatures, this whole idea of greenhouse gases and the climate adjusting. So it's really the light and the energy that's released by the sun that is then transformed in a sense by our Earth and the atmosphere that is regulating us. It's not so much the entropy per se.
There's also a paradox with that. If I can jump in, it's that, you know, everybody talks about entropy, that it only goes in one direction, and so there should be a loss of entropy. There should be a loss of order, like when if you look in your drawer where you keep your socks, it never gets more organized. It always gets messier, and that's how everything works in nature. It's a law of thermodynamics that things get more and more disordered. And that's such a law that there seems to be no exceptions. But, as the caller just pointed out, look what's happening here on Earth. We started out as kind of a molten blob. Then we had oceans. Look now. Look at all the detail. And look what we humans have done. We're not apart from nature. We're part of it. And look at all the buildings and structures and detail. Obviously, we have not gone into greater disorder on our planet right around us. So does that mean thermodynamics is wrong, and the second law of thermodynamics is invalid? No, it means that there are sections where it happens. But if you take the sun and the earth together, the mass of the two of us as a system, yes, then you get it, entropy going in only one direction.
There you go. So hopefully between the two of us, we answered your question.
Yeah, but is the sun the source of why we have become have less entropy? Is that why we have less entropy now than we have more order than less order?
Well, we wouldn't have the life and the construction that we had without it. So that's supplying the energy that's providing more order for us for now. But but we get that at the expense of the sun, because the sun's structure is slowly being lost. As it converts, 6 million tons of itself is lost every second. And so if you take the two of us as a single system, it's heading in the direction that physicists approve of. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sam, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Vox Pop. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. And let's go to another center of the universe. It's lovely Cohoes, New York. Matt, you're on.
Hey, question for you.
Okay.
The flat Earth theory is getting...
The flat Earth theory is getting what?
Yeah.
We lost you. You're dropping in and out. Huh. Oh. Must be a conspiracy.
It's not a theory, flat Earth.
Matt, you want to turn 35, 40 degrees, and I bet you come right in. Oh, my gosh.
Hey, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I was just wondering if you can disprove the flat Earth theory through astronomy somehow.
Oh, I'm sure.
I've got the best way.
Go for it.
I rarely think that I'm smart, but at least I came up with this, a way that you can prove it to yourself without relying on pictures of Earth from astronauts, because after all, they work for the government, they could be lying, and spacecraft and all the rest. You can do it yourself. Do you have any friends in California? Caller?
Matt.
No.
Matt? Do you have any friends
who
are in that direction, Colorado or that part of the country?
I don't really have any friends.
Yeah, you see, there you are. There
all
you
right.
go.
Well, talk to a relative who does. Give them a call sometime when the sun is setting here. And you'll notice the sun is setting. And ask somebody in California at that moment on the phone to look out the window and tell you where the sun is. Now, if they say that the sun is pretty high up the sky, which they will, but it's on the horizon for you, then the Earth can't be flat, can
okay.
it?
Mm-hmm.
Simple.
Right. What do you think, Matt?
It's
a shame you have nobody to tell this to, frankly.
Still thinking there's a big ice barrier with land beyond it. I don't know. I'm not sure what's going on anymore.
I know. A buddy of mine once thought the moon was very small and only 12 miles away, and I think we proved him wrong, too. But you never know, man. Thank you for the call. By the way, this email came in while we were talking to Matt and Cohoes. No subject, but this person took a photo of a comet that they don't know the name of, and it was taken in Paris, New York, in Oneida County.
Okay.
And look at this shot. It's a beautiful shot.
Hmm.
When was it taken?
It doesn't say. It says last year, last fall.
Oh, well, then last fall. That was comet Sue. Let me get the name again. Su Chinchon Atlas was the name.
Yep.
All right, fair enough.
Ago. Yep. Yeah, we could see that one with just our eyes, you know, in a relatively dark area. It was really beautiful.
Yeah, that was a good one.
All right, the number here is 800-348-2551. We'll get back to the phones in a moment. A couple of more emails. This one's from Greg. Is there a quantum model of gravity where the curvature of space is a function of quantum probability?
Oh, they're desperate for that. Physicists desperately want to create a quantum theory of gravity, but no dice so far.
No, I wish. You know, like, they keep trying. You know, the smartest people in the world are literally trying to put all the math together to do this, and we just haven't figured it out yet.
All right. Well, sorry, Greg.
Yeah.
Astronomy question from Dylan in Cummington, Mass. I was wondering if there's a theory on what space is inside of. Valerie, you go first.
Well, it can't really be inside of anything. If we define our universe as everything we see and perceive, then there's nothing beyond it. We're not, you know, inside of a container and growing out to fill the container. That's not a proper way of thinking about it. We know that, you know, in between the stars, we just have vacuum energy, this energy that persists throughout space and the universe. But the universe literally is everything. We can't really think about being inside of something else. We have no evidence that there are other places out there to be. So we are just it.
Yeah, it's, and also, know, if it didn't just thought, if but... it wasn't just empty and kept going on and on, why would we call it space?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
The very word.
What would we call it?
Well, it's not space if it's emptiness and goes on and on. We even use the word in a non-astronomical way, of course. We say, hey, give me some space. We're not talking about a confined thing when we talk that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
No, you're right. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. Let's go back to the phones, and we'll go to Western Massachusetts. Rick, you're on.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling from Greenfield on the far side of the Berkshires, Franklin County.
Okay.
My question is the end of our solar system. Why did we lose Pluto as a planet, and when can we get it back?
Okay.
I'll listen off the air. Thanks.
You got it. All right.
We love Pluto. It's still there. You know, it didn't disappear. It didn't leave the solar system. We just call it something different now. So Pluto still sits, you know, billions of miles away from the sun. It's still bound to the sun under gravity. And there's many objects even beyond Pluto that are part of our solar system. So it's still there. We just decided that it was basically too small, and it fit better in a category of dwarf planets, smaller objects, many of which are at the edge of the solar system too. And it just looks more like those objects. So instead of creating this never-ending list of planets, we said we're going to keep the eight planets and any other small things like Pluto, we're going to put them in a different category.
It's very exclusionary, and I don't like it. Bob, is that part of the Kuiper Belt?
It is. It is part of the Kuiper Belt. And we had no choice. Even the caller would have done the same thing. We all would have done the same thing, because the problem was that we kept finding more Plutos, and some of them were bigger, like Eris, which is near Pluto, but it's bigger. Now, if Pluto's a planet, so is Eris, so is Sedna, so is Quarwar, so is many of the Kuiper larger.
It's a big tent, man. Go. Do it.
So, you know, didn't you have a poster when you were a kid of the planets?
I sure did.
I sure did, too. Mm-hmm. And at that time, there were nine, and you could keep track of them. How would you like it if there were 900?
I'd love that. By the way.
I mean, kindergarten teachers would disagree.
Well, I think you're probably right. You know, the thing is, have they been able to, with things like the web or Hubble, mm-hmm. map and count the number of objects in the Kuiper Belt?
They're trying. So the field of view of these massive telescopes that have the ability to see these types of things is very small. So we can only look at small pieces at a time, and we can, and we have, found quite a few more objects at the edge of the solar system in this Kuiper Belt, but it's just going to take time to map it out. And of course, the scientists that care about the edge of the solar system have to fight for time with those that care about other stuff.
Yeah.
So we're not always looking at right where this belt is all the time.
Or put it this way, which is easier, which is less cumbersome? To either have lists of hundreds, maybe thousands of objects that are about the size of Pluto and all call them planets, or alternatively say, hey, you're out of here. We've got eight objects that are very different orbits, different shape orbits, different sizes. They're all similar to each other. Mm-hmm. You're more similar to the Kuiper Belt objects, of which there's a zillion of. Let's put you in a different category.
It
was just logical.
It needed a better agent.
Yeah, we tell the kids that, you know, Pluto just found a new group of friends that he gets along with better.
Oh, really?
You know, that's
you tell the college kids
it.
That?
No, the little kids that come to the planetary. Although sometimes the college kids need that kind of level, too.
So Jenny writes in, proof that the Earth isn't flat. If the Earth was flat, a cat would have pushed everything off
that
by now.
Yeah, that's funny.
That's
funny.
Nice. Thank you.
There's another proof, too, and that is, I mentioned this once before, but we finished with swimming season, but the next time you're in a big, big lake, one that doesn't have a lot of waves, hold your breath, lower your head till your eyes are just over the surface, and look at the far shore, and you'll see it disappear over the curvature of the lake. Mm-hmm. So the lake represents a little part of Earth's curvature. And what I'm saying is you can see Earth's curve for yourself without even asking anyone else for help.
All right. Jose writes in, Neil deGrasse Tyson says, cold does not exist, but the universe, which is everything, is absolutely cold. How can you explain that? The comment is absolutely true. Let's not forget that Tyson has been wrong on other topics and corrected. And that's from Jose.
Well, it depends on how you're thinking about cold and temperature, right? Like when we talk about the coldness of space, you don't necessarily feel the cold because what it really is the particles are moving so slowly that they represent a very cold temperature. But if you actually got like just above the atmosphere on Earth, you'd feel a lot of physical heat from the sun. There's just so few particles to actually give you that sensation of heat. Yeah. So we say that it feels colder because of that.
All right, let's go to the phones. Jeremy's in Troy. Jeremy, you're on.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
So I have a question about dark matter. I understand that we haven't been able to discover it enough to touch it, but we know it's there. Mm-hmm. If we were to find it, what could we do with it?
Ah, okay. Well, we have about a minute and a half, so go for it.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure we could come up with all sorts of crazy things. I don't think we can really answer that question until we physically know what it is, right? Because we know that it interacts gravitationally, but so does regular matter, right? So what are those different properties of dark matter? We don't know anything more about it to be able to know how we could utilize it for something. Maybe we could make, like, dark matter engines and rocket ships. Maybe things work differently. But until we have all the properties, I don't know.
Bob.
Or dark
what
matter.
What about antimatter?
Well, dark matter could be, that is a different matter entirely. Antimatter has nothing to do with dark matter. But dark matter could also be subatomic particles that are more massive than any of the ones we know of. Mm-hmm. In which case, if they remain free-floating subatomic particles, you're not going to be able to do anything with it, really. So as Valerie said, we got to know what it is first.
Yeah. All right. Jeremy, you good with that?
Yes, that answers my question. Thank you.
All right, fair enough. All right, we only have about a minute left here. Antimatter, what is antimatter?
Antimatter, we know what that stuff is. You can think about like the exact opposite, a mirror image in a sense of our subatomic particles, our protons, our electrons. They're objects with similar properties like mass and size, but they have opposite charge.
Okay.
That's the only difference. The electric charge is opposite.
Richard in Pittsfield, you only have about 15 seconds. Go ahead.
No, hi there. Okay. I was wondering why my television signal drops off on only one channel during the day, but not the other ones. It's an antenna signal, and I'm concerned the sun is taking out my Fox Sports football game.
Darn it. Well, I'll tell you what. We may not have time for that today, but the Science Forum comes your way a week from today. And Roger Jaboni will be on, who knows a lot about radio propagation and stuff like that. So if you can hang in there, call next Thursday. We will answer that question, or try anyway, to answer that question for you. Richard, we're going to let you go. All right, Valerie Rapson, if people want to find out about that wicked cool planetarium, how do they do it?
Yes, lots of planetarium shows coming up, and we're also going to have some public observing. First announcement, it's November 14th.
What is public observing?
We're going to bring people to the telescopes
for the first time in a long time.
All right, I got to double check.
I want to make sure my dates are right.
Bob, go, go, go.
If people want to find out about your tours and stuff, how do they do that?
Bob Berman Tours.
Okay. Yes, Friday, November 14th. 6 o'clock, come up to college camp. We're just going to start to announce it next week. The word's coming out. So check our socials.
I got to tell you, I'm not huge on doing these WAMC on the road events. I wouldn't mind doing a star party sometime.
That would be
over
fun.
There.
Let's do it.
All right. Well, I'll talk to my agent. Support comes from Humphrey Garden Design Landscape in Massachusetts, working with homeowners and businesses with landscape plantings, gardens, hardscapes since 2001. Make it beautiful where you live. 413-863-4054. And BigGayHudsonValley.com, working to build queer community since 2008, featuring original events, happenings, calendar, resource directory, more, newsletter, and details at BigGayHudsonValley.com. Thanks again to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for being here today. Thank you for listening. Tremendous calls. And sorry if we didn't get to yours or your emails. We will do it again next month. Thanks to our engineer. Okay, it's Riley Phillips, right? I didn't write it down, but now I'm starting to remember. It's only been a few times. And Jim Montier, thanks for screening the calls, buddy. Tomorrow it's a Food Friday. We welcome back Chef Gail Sokol for another baking session. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.